by working in computer science, in computing, at the end of the road there are not only papers, but real products, real things that are used by many, many people.
So what got you interested in biophysics?
I like the outdoors, and I like life, basically. Like, for example, I had an aquarium when I was a child, and so I loved to take care of the fishes, and I wanted to know how they work. I saw the fishes multiplying, getting young ones, grow, and so we are like little living machines where I expected the laws of physics would also hold, and I wanted to explain how they actually managed to swim, to see, and to eat. And so on the one side I was a mathematician, on the other side I loved living systems, and so the combination of the two is in a way where these lines intersect.
What actually made you interested in memory, specifically, in your first job?
I mean, that's what my research was on. I took tons of religion classes. It just made me think about mind and how can this be true? You know, we were taught that we were special, and when we died, we would go to heaven, and no one else would go to heaven because they hadn't been baptized in the Catholic Church, and so on and so forth. And I think all these things, it just didn't quite add up for me. I was always trying to think, well, could this really be true? Sort of like when I was really little, I realized that Santa Claus could not be. How could there be a Santa Claus at this store and that store? And this doesn't make any sense. This is baloney. So I think I was always trying to solve problems, especially problems about behavior, like how could Santa be in two places at one time? Well, he couldn't be. Therefore, this guy that you're in front of is not Santa Claus. You know, we would be told all these mystical principles, and I would think about them really carefully, and then I would realize that, for me, they didn't completely add up, and this was really troubling to me. I think sort of being told these pretty dogmatic facts about behavior made me really interested in behavior from a more scientific perspective.
I guess I was a mama's boy. I think the biggest influence from my mother is not so much anything specific about career choice, it's an attitude. And I mean, I think the best part of the attitude is you get to a certain point and you try to understand things, but you can't understand them because there are certain things that are really beyond my understanding, I think beyond human understanding. And, you know, I just go back to that wonderful phrase that you had, life is funny.
Family members had a great impact on some of these individuals in a positive and sometimes negative way, even affecting them years later.
My mother pushed me toward intellectual life. She always claims that I am a person that will be unhappy unless he's doing brainy work. So she pushed me toward brainy work. So that was certainly influential, and she pushed me toward learning. You know, certainly the help of family. You do not succeed without having a lot of help of your family in a career.
It was probably my dad, who was a really smart guy. He was very achievement-oriented and was very proud of my accomplishments when I was a child and made me feel very driven to be successful. And I always thought sort of differently than other girls my age. I think my dad was sort of proud of that. I don't think my mother was particularly proud of it. She wished I would be more girly.
My dad was trained as an engineer, electrical engineer. So he's very creative, and he loves to always do things. Thinking back, I think that has a lot of effect on me. Like, he will always have little projects, say, raising the chickens. Some of the things I was able to participate, some of the things I was able to observe. So I think all those projects really helped me to be creative and to let your imagination go.
Role models have played an equally formative and inspirational part in each individual's academic career. From high school chemistry teachers to talented family, U of I researchers have found motivation in a remarkable group of mentors.
My aunt is a neurologist, so I had decided to go into psychology, but I was thinking at the time more like clinical work, like taking care of counseling. And then I went on vacation with her right before I started college. And again, she's a neurologist, and there was a flood. She's cursed. I mean, anytime she goes on vacation, there are floods, there are things. So we were stuck in a hotel with this flood, and she was telling me about her job and about brain anatomy and things like that. And I really was hooked by talking to me about these things. Certainly she influenced me on what was cool and what I wanted to do.
He was probably my only role model. He was a person who was interested in finding out how things worked, and that was something that I picked up too. And I continue to be motivated primarily by finding out how things work, trying to determine how to make things work better. And it doesn't matter much what area it is. I'm interested in everything. I think that was partially because he was interested in everything.
Many of the scientists interviewed credit some of their motivation to teachers. However, each teacher was inspiring in a different way.
My physics teacher really was not very good. And so he was in many ways almost an anti-role model. I didn't really understand what he was talking about. And so it really intrigued me. I thought there must be more to it than this. And so it was almost despite of him that I went into physics and got interested in physics.
Just getting me interested and excited about science, I had a very, very good biology teacher, Mr. Steinkamp, and Mrs. Mariotti taught chemistry. And I remember those two in particular, just because they knew the subject so well and were really passionate about teaching the students so that they could understand and appreciate those subjects in the way that they did.
One of my first professors in linguistics, her name is Donna Jo Napoli. She's now very well known as an author of children's books. And she was a mother. She has five children, and she had accomplished a lot, both in her personal life and also with her career. And so that gave me a lot of inspiration.
Father O'Hara, who had been a university professor at one point in his career, he was a mathematician, and he'd written some quite well-regarded textbooks on mathematics. And he came across me in the corridor one day, and he said, "I somehow get the impression you have a lot of spare time on your hands." I said, "Yeah, you can say that again." So he said, "Well, you know, so happens I have quite a lot of spare time on my hands. Why don't you come along to my room a couple of hours a week, and I will show you some interesting things in modern mathematics?" Now, you have to realize that they essentially know mathematics, and to my great surprise, not only could I do these problems, I actually rather enjoyed doing them.
Looking up to other respected and esteemed people drove some of these scientists to perform their best and push themselves to their limits.
I was fortunate enough to go to a school where there were some very famous linguists, including Noam Chomsky. My very first class that I took with him, I was nervous, and he was the most famous person that I'd ever taken a class with. And so we went to the lecture hall, and it was a huge lecture hall, but we were a small group. We were like 10 of us. And the most amazing thing was that it filled up quickly. There was over 100, probably close to 200 people in the lecture hall. And I was just amazed that there were even that many people in one town who would be interested enough in linguistics to come. And it was at that time that I really became impressed that, you know, one person who's had some really big ideas and influenced the field can attract so many other people to come and listen to him speak.
There's certainly the role models on the research side. I'm a pretty good researcher, I'm a pretty good scientist, but there are so many people that I think they are just so much better than I am, and they are just so much smarter. And those are my role models as far as science goes. And I need those because they drive me to do better and to try harder. But then they're also role models in terms of leaders. They were great scientists and researchers in their own rights, but they also had wonderful human capabilities and knew how to lead people, knew how to get the best out of every single one, and always knew how to be encouraging and be positive.
Educational backgrounds of the 15 scientists interviewed revealed the varied nature of U of I faculty, staff, and business partners. One faculty member attended a conservative Catholic grade school, in which she claims her curiosity was frowned upon. In contrast, another attended an experimental school in Taiwan, where she had a lot of freedom to explore her vocation. Most recall their years of academic study with enjoyment. A few do so with melancholy. Either way, education has greatly impacted each individual's career.
I think the grade school is a general education. I had a wonderful time. It's a great school. And then I had a wonderful teacher that opened up a lot of imaginations for me. It was a tough school, but it was a well-balanced school. From the place where I came from, it was quite rare. If you know the education system in those countries, it's high pressure from the societies, and then you have to take a unified exam to get into kindergarten. You have to get a unified exam to get into elementary schools and into junior high, into high school. It's all the way up, exams and exams and exams. And then in the schools, they always prepare you for the exams. So it's very one-sided study, one-sided education. There was, so you have the school whole day until 6 o'clock, you go home, and then you go for extra study with the teachers after dinner. So it was high pressure, but the school that I went to was an experimental school, so they provide very balanced education. So I had a great time, basically quite free in our ways and approaches, and I think that has gave me a very good foundation. College is a time that your awareness of yourself, your interest, the world around you, and different practices, different culture, different way of thinking, you start to explore and being exposed to that. Subconsciously, that did influence me, and I was continuously growing. Now, looking back, it was like an explosive time in my life. All of a sudden, the world was open to me, and it's very different, and I just keep on absorbing. The one that kind of guided in this direction was when I was at University of California. I had an opportunity to work as a work-study student with an engineering professor at his lab. And that lab does image processing and trying to use computer technology to detect automatically tumors in the breast. In those days, mammogram became available, so the information, the image can be digitized and put in the computer. So it was important to try to distinguish between the benign tumor versus cancer. And then this laboratory was doing that work. And then I was fortunate to be accepted into that lab to work as an undergraduate student. And I think that was very interesting. And then that's what I'm doing today, combining the computer and engineering technology with medical.
The schools these individuals attended influenced their interests and offered them new experiences.
When I went to college, the first class I took was Psychology 101. I'd always spent a lot of time thinking about the mind and things of that sort, and when I found out that people had developed techniques to measure the mind and measure memory, I just thought it was totally amazing. So early on in college, one of my professors asked me what I wanted to do, and I said I wanted to be a social worker, and this is a little insulting, but he said, well, that's not a very good use of your intellect. He said, why don't you be a research psychologist? And I said, well, I can't afford it. In those days, people didn't borrow money to go to college, and it wouldn't have even crossed my mind to do that. So I just said, I can't afford to go to graduate school, and he said, well, what if you could get it paid for? So I said, well, then I would probably do it. After that professor talked to me, I wanted to be a research psychologist and study memory, and that's actually what I've done my whole life. I went to a Catholic school, and it was really restrictive, and there were lots of rules, and I was always in trouble for doing what I thought were not really stupid things. And I felt like if you asked a lot of questions, you got in trouble. We weren't supposed to be curious. So when I went to college and I found out I never got in trouble anymore, and people liked it if you asked questions. So when I got to college, I knew I never wanted to leave a university. And I never have.
I went to Georgia Tech. The reason I went there was that I found a program that the U.S. Navy was running, a cooperative education program. You would work for 3 months, go to school for 3 months, and then work for 3 months. So I got a job as an engineering trainee at the Naval Ordnance Laboratory in White Oak, Maryland, and then alternated that work with school. It was totally an accident. It was a way of paying my way through undergraduate school, but I think, thinking back on it, it was probably one of the best choices I could have made because it allowed me to work with cutting-edge technology at the same time I was learning. The application of my learning wasn't something that was going to be happening in 4 years. It was happening every 3 months.
The colleges and universities these individuals went to allowed them to continue exploring new areas and doing diverse things that helped them map out their futures.
Being exposed to other technologies and other sciences, I very quickly became interested in other fields as well. I was not the best student, either as an undergraduate or as a graduate student. I got led astray on things that were a little bit more interesting than what was in the course material. I never had a course that I didn't make use of later on, but I didn't always shine in my performance. It was a very productive time, but my transcript doesn't show that.
I knew from the beginning of my studies, actually, that I really loved life science, but my brain is made for mathematics. And so I first studied mathematics and physics in Münster and got my master. But then I knew always I wanted to go to really study living systems. And I knew that there was one person at Harvard who was one of the few people who, as a physicist, approached the study of living systems. Today this is very common, but in those days it was rare, and he was maybe one of maybe three in the world. That is why I went there. And so then I basically tried to join this person's group as quickly as I could to work with him and to see how I can become, as a physicist, actually a life scientist.
The greatest achievement in college was that I was able to find something that I felt really passionate about. I was able to identify a career for myself in something that still interests me as much today as it did the day I first discovered it.
Something about the University of Illinois attracted these 15 scientists to the Midwestern town of Champaign-Urbana. The university's academic excellence and intellectually stimulating community are perhaps its two most notable assets. These factors, among others, are what have drawn some of the country's and the world's best and brightest.
I wasn't really looking to leave, but then a colleague who is working here called me one day and said, there's this opportunity here at the Beckman Institute, the current director is retiring, and so they are looking for a new director. Would you be interested? I came and visited, and the more I actually learned about the Beckman Institute, the more excited I got. And it is really a very unique place. It's this research institution where people from many different backgrounds do come together to work on large and complex problems. So we have people from, I think, close to 30 different departments who are doing research at the Beckman Institute. So there are some 110 different professors from across the whole campus who come together there with very different backgrounds, and together with their students, they work on these very large and interdisciplinary projects.
I got to know some people that were here, and also just by sheer number and the size of the school, it has so many different disciplines, so many different aspects, such as electrical engineering, computer engineering, chemical engineering, you name it. And they are all very high quality.
I enjoy here the rich cultural life, the rich intellectual life, and the social life. I enjoy my job, and what I'm doing in the computer science department, the feeling of constructing something which hopefully will be around for many decades to come and having a real impact on how this department will look for many decades to come.
But not all of the professors interviewed spoke highly of the University of Illinois.
I think that the university has gotten so big, I don't think it's quite as friendly. In those days, we were after something and so forth. But today, they're after something, but they're after something for their own interests.
One said the University of Illinois is attractive because of its bright minds and the great science done at the university.
I realized what a splendid place it is, full of intelligent people, great students, and really a place where you can get a lot of work done and can focus on your scientific life. My wife also had a good opportunity here. She's today also a professor at the university. And so then we decided we both come here and try it here.
Many of the faculty members interviewed immigrated to the University of Illinois from Europe and Asia.
When I came here, I had enough English to read, so I could read in English and I could do basic writing, but high-speed conversation about anything was hard. So the first semester or so, just managing daily lives was difficult. I remember the parking office called. At the time, we needed to have stickers on things, on vehicles, and so the parking office called me at home. And I couldn't get at all what they wanted from me. I only got that was the parking office and I should go there. So I did go there and I got my sticker, but it wasn't an obvious thing to me. But that passed. Like within 6 months, everything was fine.
Not only is the University of Illinois' culture different, but the colleges are as well.
The universities in Germany are huge and there are much larger numbers of students. And in America, it's much more like a school. You're being told what to do, and it's more concentrated on individuals. And so this was a wonderful experience for me to go from a huge public university to a small private university. And so I felt more taken care of. I lived in a nice dormitory. I had a good food plan. The institute was just across the street where I took my courses and later did my research. And so it was just a wonderful, almost cloistered environment.
I like this community. The university is a big part of it, but it's also the kinds of people who are around a university, people who have a tendency to think for themselves, to have some variety of thoughts, some variety of lifestyles. It's just interesting.
The computer science here is a long tradition. The Digital Compute Laboratory was opened in 1949. The first computers built in academia was built here, the ILIAC. So there is a long tradition. It's a great university. It's a place where top research is done in computer science as well as in many other areas. And it's a place which will continue to move fast in the coming years. So there will be many opportunities, I think, for starting new research areas, starting new education programs. Computer science or computing in general is still evolving very rapidly. You see industry evolving very rapidly. You know, the internet didn't exist 15 years ago, and now everybody uses it. Companies like Google didn't exist 8 years ago. They're fairly young. And now everybody uses Google. And things continue to move very rapidly. So being in a field where technology is changing very rapidly really forces you to not to stay in one place, to evolve rapidly. And I think that's what we will have to do to continue to be a top department, and that's a very pleasant challenge.
University of Illinois researchers have touched people's lives in surprising ways, while at the same time contributing to the world's scientific knowledge. For example, the U of I is a hotbed of cutting-edge computer hardware and software. Someday, thanks to U of I professors, we may have stretchable silicon and roll-up electronic newspapers. Other U of I scientists are working on ways to identify infants with hearing loss. The University of Illinois is a virtual cornucopia of technological investigation.
We're interested in other kinds of materials, polymers and plastics, that would allow you to build electronic devices that behave like silicon devices at the circuit level, but enable a sort of form factors, mechanical characteristics, weights and things like that that can't be achieved with relatively heavy, brittle, inorganic materials like silicon and glass. So we're interested in like large area, mechanically flexible circuits for wall scale displays or roll-up electronic newspaper-type systems. So really trying to bring new classes of materials into electronics, not to compete directly with silicon, but to enable new kinds of devices. And the materials are key to enabling those kinds of systems because silicon and glass are intrinsically heavy and brittle, fragile, and so they're inherently ill-suited for those kind of applications. You can also make the silicon stretchable. You'd want something more than bendable electronics. You'd want stretchable electronics so it could sort of form to the contours of your body and move with you like spandex, for example. And the way that you make it stretchable is you can form it using well-controlled mechanical buckling techniques into periodic wavy shapes. Further out into the future, you could imagine actually forming circuits on the threads that form your clothing. I mean, that's sort of way into the future, but this is the kind of vision that we have, is just being able to put electronics on anything such that it's more useful to the operator of the device. Although it's taken a little bit longer than I thought it would, it looks like those type of displays are going to make it in terms of consumer electronic device that you'd be able to buy at Circuit City or Best Buy, and it will be present in its first embodiment as a display for a PDA, a personal digital assistant, like a Palm Pilot. But the Palm Pilot won't look like a conventional Palm Pilot. You have the display roll up into the pen when you're not using it, and you kind of unfurl it when you want to use your PDA. And it looks like that's going to happen. We also work in new techniques for patterning circuits and devices out of these materials. Approach is based on stamping and molding, kind of very conceptually old ways to manipulate materials, but using new materials to allow that kind of manipulation at levels of fidelity and resolution far beyond anybody has done in the past.
Our newest product is called Middle Ear Power Analyzer. And within a few minutes, we can tell you all the physical properties of your middle ear, how the sounds is transferred from your ear canal into your inner ear.
Some of the big inventions that have been made that we could see, as a matter of fact, within the very near future, one is called the intelligent hearing aid that was invented maybe 5-6 years ago at the Beckman Institute. And this is a new kind of hearing aid that is very different from those that are used currently. Currently, the hearing aids that are used are little microphones that you put into your ears, and then they amplify the sound that comes in so people can hear better. One of the problems with those hearing aids is that there's something called the party effect, where people who wear hearing aids and they are in a room with a lot of chatter, all that chatter gets amplified, and it makes it very difficult for people wearing hearing aids to pick out one particular voice in all that background that they want to listen to. That's apparently very frustrating for people who wear hearing aids, and so then they just turn the hearing aid off and tune out of the conversation. So this intelligent hearing aid is a new concept where there are two microphones, and rather than each one independently amplifying the acoustic signal that comes to the ear, we can do something in our brain that allows us to figure out whether a voice comes from straight ahead or comes from the side. So this new intelligent hearing aid will help do that signal processing, where indeed now these two hearing aids will have a little computer between them that helps suppress all the acoustic signals that come from the sides and will amplify what comes straight at me, which will get rid of this party effect. Now it's taken on by a company called Phonak that will develop this into a real product that will be probably on the market within a year or two and will hopefully really make the life of people who have to wear hearing aids a lot better.
Part of my research is focused on developing technologies for computer speech recognition. That kind of technology, you can imagine, would have tremendous opportunity to help people who have physical disabilities that might prevent them from using a keyboard or such that they can't read a computer screen. And so having language technologies on a computer would open up the world of computing and information processing to everybody. This is a really important technology that people have been working on for over 20 years. And although a lot of progress has been made, we're still a long way away from being able to sit down in front of our computer and have it get information and type up papers for us without touching a keyboard. But computers are probably the biggest tools that linguists use in doing their research. And at the same time, linguistic research is being applied to developing computer tools that will allow people to use spoken language to interact with your computer.
Could you describe more in depth on what your research with the fMRI is?
We'll bring individuals into the imaging facility. We present them with images from the computer, like we might say, we're going to show you a series of pictures and we want you to study these pictures. Later, we might say, here's a new series of pictures. Tell us if you studied this picture before. And some of them were pictures they did study and some were pictures they didn't. We can look at their brain activations for pictures that they remembered versus brain activations for pictures that they forgot. So we think that for older adults, they have to elaborate and use reasoning and higher order processes to remember, whereas young adults can rely on this more primitive part of their brain.
My interest at the moment is to study the brain as it ages and also find out whether some things could be corrected if they are problematic and compare normal brains to things that might be diseased so that you can sort of figure out what things are normal and what things become abnormal in aging and need to be followed up. In our lab, we're developing a new method that is based on light diffusing through tissue. We shine light in the tissue, and the parameters of this light change depending on whether the tissue is active or not. And this new method lets you know where and when the activity occurs. And again, it has this capability of telling you both pieces of information. You really have almost a movie of the living brain, and I think that's an important thing that we do. Ideally, I would really like an integrated view of the brain where you can have information from the cells themselves, the supporting cells, the metabolism that goes on at the same time, and the external influences that you might have, and possibly other influences from, say, one's genetics makeup or environment to understand really how things interact and work together.
I've gotten interested in how people from different cultures think. And there's some evidence that people that are East Asian, that is Chinese or Japanese or Korean, are more likely to pay attention to the context in which an event occurs. And Westerners, such as Americans, are more likely to pay attention to the target or the individual in a context. And we've done some brain imaging, and we found that East Asians tend to activate areas that involve details and background when they're looking at a complicated picture, and Americans tend to activate areas that are focused on objects. So while Asians are processing a scene in a very broad way and focusing on all the elements of the scene, Westerners are focusing primarily on the central object in the scene. And we think that that's a result of cultural differences between the two groups. So that's a pretty exciting finding, that you can literally see that the culture someone is in sculpts the way their brain functions. So that's a very exciting finding.
Right now, the way computers work is obviously using semiconductors and electronics. But there is a whole other area which is called photonics, where instead of using electrons and electrical currents, we use light. So that is the area of what we call microphotonics. We have to have a very long view here. What we are doing now in the lab is developing these new materials that allow us to manipulate light and to maybe compute with light, to use light to switch and to store. That might take another 30, 40, even 50 years.
We are actually putting whole cell into electron microscope to get the tomography of the cell. Just like a patient at Carl, you are scanning the patient, you see all the organs of a patient, you see the skeleton, you see the brain in great detail, all the blood vessels. This is what we hope to do for living cells, so that we can really visualize all the parts of the cell, so that we know where every molecule in the cell is, and that we then connect it all together to understand how it works as a whole.
I still continue to work on software for large-scale power machines. I'm interested in programming languages that can be used to write codes for parallel machines. People find it hard to think parallel. The way we think of what a computer does is very sequential. Does A's and do B's and do C's and do D. There is a challenge here. How to move from a very sequential way of thinking, which is what programming has been for tens of years, to a parallel way of thinking, where things happen simultaneously in many places. I don't know yet how to do it, but that's, in a sense, the core of my research, has been the core of my research, probably will continue to be the core of my research for many years, unless we have a wonderful success and the problem is solved. But we are far from having solved this problem. Why we are so bad at building technology that is stable, that doesn't crash, and technology which is human-friendly, that mystifies me. One area where we are growing is human-computer interaction. The research is exactly how to build computer technology that is more user-friendly, more human-friendly. And their type of research is doing experiments with people, having people try to use their systems and tell them what they like, what they dislike, what makes them slow, what makes them faster. One example of such a project is a project that deals with interruptions. Computer continuously interrupt you now. You got mail, instant messaging, beeping, or so on. Well, sometimes you are willing to be interrupted, sometimes you are not willing to be interrupted. In a social environment, you signal when you are not willing to be interrupted by closing your door or putting do not interrupt sign on your door or what have you. How computers get to know that that's the wrong time to interrupt you? Here is a non-trivial problem which requires interaction of computer technology with social science technology or psychology technology. And I think that's going to be increasingly the type of research that is done in computer science.
The results are compelling, but what about the method? The U of I researchers revealed the two are equally critical. Hard work and grit is a large part of scientific advance.
The best thing about research in general is this moment of, wow, I understand it. And it's a real rush. It's also this notion that this is something that I've been trying to understand now for half a year, and all of a sudden there's this moment of where it clicks. and it becomes crystal clear. And yes, that's the answer. That is the truth. It is still important to get research results, but it is equally important to learn the methodology, the tools to become a researcher, a scientist. How do you set up an experiment? How do you ask the right questions? How do you go about analyzing data? Learning how to do that is almost as important as the final results, which are important too, but the final results are the research results that are then being published in a journal article. But the whole process of learning how to do it is very important.
These professors face challenges and obstacles in research that they needed to overcome in order to succeed.
I don't know if it's one challenge, that's probably hundreds of challenges I manage at the time, a fairly big research group. I started working with the person in development, and I remember that he told me, well, if you are wrong, you are going to continue to do some other research, and I am going to look for a new job. And that was a moment where I realized that I pick upon myself significant responsibility. We were successful, and it became a multi-billion product, but if we had failed, many people would have looked for other jobs, would have lost their job in IBM, and that would have been a fairly costly failure. So at some point, you do research, it's challenging and it's satisfactory when you solve a hard problem, but you start pushing your research ideas into real products, and it's hundreds of millions of dollars, which depend on how good your ideas are and the livelihood of many people. So then you feel not only a challenge, but a huge sense of responsibility.
I supervised them a little, but they did most of it themselves. So they built a computer, they programmed the computer, and then they let the computer run for 3 years on the problem. And then we could do the problem that would have cost us millions and millions of dollars on the bigger computer. And that is why we are the world leader in doing this kind of simulations.
Technology is necessary in order to do scientific research, but it is also extremely expensive, and sometimes finding funding is a challenge. However, one professor and his students solved this problem on their own.
I have my name on some patents, but they didn't make the university rich, didn't make anybody rich. But I'm actually, in a way, like a businessman there, because what I have at the Beckman Institute is actually almost like a business. Because I develop software there, programs that we develop are actually used by over 70,000 life scientists in the whole world. Some companies sell software, but the way we do it is we're getting the funds for developing the software from the National Institutes of Health, and then we give it for free to the world.
While innovative products and technology are often profitable, they also help other scientists further their studies.
How have you changed Beckman's way of research or what you've been researching here?
We almost change all the time. This is one of our attributes, that we really try to keep looking out at the horizon of what are the very important questions that we should address that bring together the people with the right background to find the answers to. I don't think any small group of people is smart enough to figure this out. My preferred way is where you have a lot of smart people sit together and just talk. And that happens, interestingly enough, very often in the cafeteria in the Beckman Institute. And the accidental thing where maybe an electrical engineer sits together with a psychologist, normally their departments would be maybe like a mile apart from each other, and they would never talk to each other. It's difficult, too, because we all get so specialized, so focused, and we learn to speak our physics language, and we learn to speak how psychologists talk. So interdisciplinary research is sometimes hard because we have to start to learn to understand the language and what the other person says and what the other discipline's methodology. So there is a lot that has to be learned, and that happens very effectively at the Beckman Institute.
With technology, science is able to expand even further and allows researchers to look into things never before possible.
A sense of what's going on in industry, what the problems are, can help you to kind of connect your scientific research to other kind of application possibilities that might be very valuable to an industry or to society in general.
Technology enables you to ask questions. Once you have a burst in technology, you often have a burst in the actual content of science, because once the tools are available, then scientists can make the next step.
The research in engineering and science at the University of Illinois is so notable, the departments are ranked among the top in the nation.
Why is Champaign-Urbana a top tech city?
It has a breadth and a size in its engineering and science areas that's really unmatched, I think, sort of quality breadth and size sort of taken together. I think even at a place like MIT, the quality is very, very high, but it doesn't quite have the breadth or the number of people. And so it's really those attributes which attracted me to Illinois, because my research is highly collaborative in nature.
Probably the best thing about the Beckman Institute and my job is the incredible excitement of the people that are there, the faculty and the students and the staff, who are all very dedicated and really excited about coming. I haven't had a day where I think, oh, this is kind of, oh, this is a drag. Is it 5 o'clock yet? Can I go home? But every day I learn something new. And it's just so exciting. It's so fascinating to see the breadth of the research activities, the questions that people address, and the diversity of research that happens. I never get tired of it. I always feel lucky that I get paid to do this. This is so exciting.
Niccolo Machiavelli once said that entrepreneurs are simply those who understand that there is little difference between obstacle and opportunity and are able to turn both to their advantage. Long hours of study leading up to the acquisition of one's PhD, while expected, requires personal sacrifice. Some U of I scientists face gender discrimination. Finding funding for necessary research is often difficult and disheartening. Still, as a group, U of I scientists are resilient, persevering despite the obstacles they face.
Before I came, I started my company in my basement. It's a very lonely path, and it also was difficult to access the high technical people. Where I came from, New Jersey has many high-power technology technical people, but I wasn't close to any universities.
I think that through my whole career, it's always been feeling like I'm not talented enough, and so I work really, really hard, and then I sort of overshoot the context. And when I was in college, I didn't want to appear like a smart girl, so I would always go someplace where no one could see me to study, so that I got really good grades, and I didn't want people to think I had to study for them. And so I would always try to secretly study, and I tried to act dumb. I don't know if that was a hardship, but it seems pretty stupid in retrospect. I mean, I wasn't dumb, and I didn't want to be dumb, but I didn't think people would like me if they thought I was smart.
I was a poor student, but the school was wonderful. They put together a package for me. I came to the United States alone at the age of 19, and went to the university, and I only had $2,000 in my pocket to go through the rest of my life. So I had this opportunity to talk to the financial officer, and then she put together a package for me to help me. There was scholarship, there was a work-study program, and there were loans. So I was able to work on campus up to 20 hours per week. But I had to be a full-time student. So it was full-time coursework and 20 hours per week. But you can get works that doesn't help you, but I got a work in a laboratory that was very influential to me.
As a young student, when I came here for graduate school, one thing that was obvious to me is that most people in the faculty were actually men. And so it is kind of daunting sometimes when you think, okay, I want to be a faculty and I want to be a professor in a university and do research. Can I make it as a woman? I also wanted a family. I wanted the cake and eat it all. And to some extent, there weren't too many examples. Now that more women are in professional jobs and have families, they might help younger students to figure out that that's possible.
Not being taken seriously by professors and having professors view me more as an attractive young woman than as a serious scientific mind. So that got complicated. Graduate school wasn't a very happy time for me, I don't think.
What was getting your PhD like?
It was a lot of long nights and struggling with the equipment, try to make the lasers work. And as soon as you get them to work, you try to frantically do your experiments before they stop working again, because everything's right on the hairy edge of not working. So it could be frustrating at times, but it was very rewarding when the experiments would work out and you would get a clean set of data and you could say something new about the way nature was operating in terms of the chemistry and how things were reacting.
Do you feel any pressure to keep on producing your inventions at this level?
I don't feel the pressure from outside. I feel the pressure from within, simply because having done it, knowing I can do it, and then as we develop better understanding allows me to realize its potential, what it can do. I want to do more.
I think there's always obstacles in research. There's always things that go wrong. The worst thing that can go wrong is you have a bad idea and you spend years pursuing the idea and it actually doesn't pan out. Sometimes somebody that you rely on a lot will unexpectedly quit for one reason or another. That can be pretty bad. A paper that you think is really good that you spend a lot of time on, maybe it won't get accepted and it'll be distressing. I'm constantly having to write grants to pay for all the staff that I hire. There's one obstacle after another, actually, and keeping the obstacles in perspective and sort of doing the math between, well, here's the obstacles and here's the payoffs and here's what I've accomplished and here's what I've had to do to get to accomplish these things. I think the trick is to try to stay optimistic and to minimize the obstacles and maximize the successes so you keep going.
As a young person, we all have dreams. It was a very rare opportunity for me to come to the United States. I did not have my family, but I had a younger sister with me. At that age, you have so much ahead of you, and you can make anything out of yourself. We just explore all the opportunity, and then we study hard and work hard. It's pretty scary, think back, that two little girls here in the United States all by themselves. But there was some Christian group that my parents knew. They gave us homes and gave us love and gave us support that I really appreciate. Just believe another day. Just believe another day.
Many people view professors as teachers, not learners. As a group, those interviewed suggest that's not the case. They say they've learned from their students, their colleagues, and their mistakes, and not just in the laboratory. They've also picked up valuable life lessons. The best moments for some are those that lead students and teachers together to a rewardingly educational common ground.
The thing today that I've seen is that the kids today don't know how to write. A lot of them are too dependent upon calculators, computers, and so forth. You have to be able to think with the brain. They have to go to school, learn their English, learn their mathematics, and not only that, they have to be well-versed not in just those subjects, but other subjects also.
If you want to do something exciting, then you need to be your own boss. You need to explore on your own. Solve the problems and then find out the things that you're interested in on your own.
All of these University of Illinois faculty members have accomplished a great deal in their careers. But at the end of the day, many claim they just love the work they do.
The pleasure is to do work that you find still resonates 15 years, 20 years after you've done it, and have such results that are used by other researchers or are used by practitioners in the design of systems.
Do you think that you made the most out of your career as possible?
Oh, no. And that's why I continue being interested in everything that I encounter. There are only 24 hours in the day, unfortunately, and there are so many interesting things going on, and there are so many things that I would like to understand more than I understand now. Every day is an opportunity to try to learn something new.
Coming from another culture and background, one professor appreciates the opportunities the U.S. offers to everyone.
Coming from a complete different cultural background and with different opportunities, I think my short lifespan actually had covered a much longer lifespan of changes of technology because where I came from. In the United States, there are a lot of problems simply because we have good media to allow you to know things that are happening. But this is one of the greatest countries in the world, and it has so many opportunities that's waiting for you. The discrimination is minimal. I think any time when there's discrimination is because of the competition. Whenever you have competition, then some of the things can be turned into discrimination, which boils down to competition for better things and for resources. But here, anyone that works hard, you have the best freedom, best resources, best support for you to be creative, to invent, to make the best out of yourself. I count myself very fortunate to come to the United States. I thought I would go home after a year of state because that's what I told the officer. I couldn't wait to go home. But it's over 30 years, and I'm here, and I'm still enjoying it. And this is becoming my home, my country, and I've been benefited and supported. If I stay in Taiwan or China, I would never have developed to the point that I am. I would never have been able to enjoy the kind of work that I'm doing now, and I expect to continue. The only thing is that I sometimes, like riding a wild horse, you need to learn how to control it so I don't burn up too fast, but appreciate what you have.
There were many roads not taken in my career. When I started, I didn't know I would become a computer scientist. When I was doing more theoretical work, it was not clear I would work on more applied technologies. I didn't plan to spend 15 years at IBM. I didn't plan to become involved in the largest computers ever built, which I had the opportunity at IBM. I certainly didn't plan moving here. So there were a lot of unplanned moves. And by now, I come to the realization that you don't plan your life. It happens. It's really making the most of the opportunities, not carefully planning what these opportunities will be. And I was lucky to have many good opportunities in my life.
One hopes to be useful, and so if one day that one can feel, looking back, that one has done something useful. So I try this, for example, by giving other people access to the tools we have. You have this big group, and half of the group is not really scientists, and I do this only because I feel very strongly that other people should also benefit from what we are doing. And so we share our software with many other people. So that is what I'm proud of, that I not only share it, I also go out of my way to train other people in this, to tell people what are really the concepts and the algorithms behind these programs and how are they used properly. I train them hands-on, that they really learn how to really do it too, to use this computational microscope by themselves. And so that is one way I hope I can give back to society the many wonderful things I got being assigned a well-funded scientist.
We hope you've enjoyed Widgets and Digits, Technological History, Research, and Invention at the University of Illinois. This program was produced by University Laboratory High School students Cinda Aga, Catherine Allen, Alex Ingalls, Maria Gao, Rachel Harmon, Linda Lee, and Maritza Mestre. The executive producer is Ruth Welch. Interviews were conducted by the 2010 University Laboratory High School sub-freshman class. The interviewees included Pat Allen, Alan Avner, Jennifer Cole, Monica Fabiani, David Goldberg, Eric Jacobson, Paul Lauterbur, Tony Leggett, Harold Lotman, Denise Park, John Rogers, Paul Saylor, Klaus Schulten, Mark Sneer, and Pierre Wiltsius. For more information on this project, visit our website at will.uiuc.edu. That's will.uiuc.edu. This program was directed by Dave Dickey of AM 580 and University Laboratory High School teacher Jenny Yi Kim. I'm Maria Gao.
And this is Maritza Mestre.
Public Radio International, I'm Ray Suarez. On the next America Abroad, allies at a crossroads, Turkey and the U.S. From the Armenian Genocide Resolution, to the PKK, to the role of Islam in Turkish society, we'll travel across Turkey to explore the country's changing political landscape and the implications for the U.S.-Turkey alliance.
Tuesday morning at 10, here on WILL Urbana.
The weather forecast for the Champaign-Urbana area today, some snow likely this afternoon, little or no accumulation likely in the Champaign-Urbana area, although areas to the northwest could receive a couple of inches of snow.